Welcome to the Allan Gray Podcast. I am Rory Katuska-Jacobson, a portfolio manager on Allan Gray's investment team and your host for this episode. Today, we are going to look at a few of the disruptive trends impacting the investment theses of some of the bigger consumer-facing shares in our portfolios and how these companies are in turn responding. In this conversation, I'm joined by my colleagues, Jethen Pillay and Sipisek Lezwane. Jethen has been with Allan Gray since 2013, and he co-manages portions of the equity and domestic balance mandates. Sipisek joined us in 2017, and he manages portions of the institutional domestic equity mandates and the SA equity portfolio. Gents, thank you for joining me today. You've both been on the show before, so you're no stranger to our listeners. But maybe just to give the listener some insight into your personal lives, Jethen, what do you do on the weekend to relax or unwind?
I'd spare the listeners if they didn't know a little bit about my personal life. But nevertheless, maybe I'm getting older now, but for me, the weekend is a weekend where there's as less to do as possible is actually one of the better ones. So it's really just unwinding, socializing with kind of friends and family, maybe going out to the wine farms that's around Cape Town, and then, yeah, just relaxing, actually.
The correct answer was the same thing I do Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, focused on investments, trying to find ideas.
That's all the time. I mean, that's what you do at the wine farms, right?
So, for secular, maybe a slightly different question for yourself. Which movie or TV franchise influenced you the most growing up?
I'm glad you didn't ask me the weekend question. It would have been a very, very different answer to Jethen's. So, I mean, similar to a lot of people my age, is Dragon Ball Z.
Dragon Ball Z.
Dragon Ball Z, yes. People my age, if you don't have DSTV, SABC2, 4:30 or 5:00, everyone's waiting to watch Dragon Ball Z. It was an amazing show, and it taught us a lot about, you know, the power of perseverance, working hard, and the spirit of friendship and family and working for that. So another one on the Disney side, the original Lion King was very good for me. So it's the first movie that made me cry as a kid. I remember watching it, and we had the cassette tape.
At the end when Scar dies.
Oh, Scar was such
Are a you ruining it?
Spoiler alert for the...
He always wanted a brother. Yeah, and then there was the spin-off cartoon, the Timon and Pumbaa cartoon that used to play, I think, on SABC2 as well, which was quite cool.
Okay, gents, let's dive straight into it. Today, we're going to talk about three of our arguably more contentious shares, all of which the listener should be familiar with: British American Tobacco, Anheuser-Busch InBev, and Disney. Over the last kind of decade or two, most of these companies have faced their fair share of controversies, and in points of time have had too much debt on their balance sheets, fallen out of favor with the market, but we're finding value in them. So let's unpack why. Maybe starting with British American Tobacco, what are people worried about?
I think we've probably written a lot of articles in the past about tobacco economics, and the idea there is, even though there's way less smokers now than there were in the 80s, or at least as a proportion of population, the people who smoke has decreased significantly from the 80s when it peaked, because the pricing or the pricing elasticity is quite weak, actually. So you're able to increase the prices to offset the declines in volumes. And even though volumes are shrinking, revenue has grown because you can pick up prices. And there's this weird thing because excise is such a big portion of the sale price. If excises stay flat, you can increase your price by, let's say, a percentage, and then it ends up, or the retailer can increase the price by a percentage, and it can end up being more than a percentage in the revenue received to the company. So that's worked quite well for most of the past.
But that can't work into perpetuity.
Yeah, you can't. You can't just 1%, 1%, 1%, and then eventually it goes to zero, right? So around 2018, that number started to increase. So I guess the big markets of the US, it used to be like a 2% decline per year, and then that number has been ticking up, and now it's like, you know, going towards double digits decline in some of the more recent years.
And is that volume decline trend, is that kind of consistent across most geographies, or do you see quite a lot of variance in terms of traditional cigarette volumes declining?
So I guess most of the big markets it's declining, but there's a few emerging markets where, because of population growth, it helps a bit, but the incidence levels in most countries are declining. And what that does is puts more pressure on pricing to work harder, and then eventually the revenue stops growing. I mean, countries like Australia, where excise taxes have increased a lot, prices are very high, volumes go backwards, and you can't pick up prices to make up for that. And in the US, for the last, say, 2 years, British American Tobacco has struggled to increase revenue as well. because the pricing couldn't be pushed enough to make up for the volume declines. So, I mean, that's the main issue and the main worries. And there's many reasons for why the volumes have decreased, such as health reasons and substitutes and things like that. But I guess we can get into that as we go on.
So essentially, I mean, what we've seen over the last 10, 15 years is that for a number of years, tobacco companies have pushed prices in the absence of volume growth and, in fact, in the face of declining volumes. But increasingly so, they've reached an inflection point despite the elasticity you were referring to, that actually they're unable to push prices to offset those volume declines. The reasons are numerous, but I mean, I think it's the main one is people are increasingly cognizant of the health impact of cigarettes, and it's increasingly then, therefore, less socially acceptable to smoke. And I guess most countries have introduced a number of kind of bans in terms of where you can and can't smoke, which has also made it less socially popular. That's quite a big negative. What's the positive? I mean, how are we seeing value then in British American Tobacco?
In the past, that volume decline actually made for amazing economics, whereas most businesses have to reinvest in growth and, you know, put cash back in. Cigarette businesses were able to pay out a whole lot of cash, generate very good returns, even though the volumes are declining. So what has changed since is that there's these less harmful products, and there's different categories of them, which have changed, I guess, the demand profile of cigarettes longer term or have reduced the health risk, which means that longer term, the decline in volumes has slowed down. When I say volumes, I don't mean volumes in cigarettes, but volumes in nicotine as a category. And I think it's important to pull away from nicotine versus just cigarettes or tobacco, because combustion of tobacco is where most of the health concerns are. But if you don't combust the tobacco or just nicotine on its own, it has very different sort of health consequences. And nicotine is addictive, but the health consequences are very different versus combusted tobacco. So volumes for things like vapor or heated tobacco products, or more recently, which has been growing a lot, is for oral tobacco.
I think most people are familiar with vaping, but maybe just very quickly describe what heat not burn is and modern oral pouches are.
Effectively, it taps into the old school traditions of things like snus and other oral tobacco forms or forms of consumption. So, but it's way more cleanly. So it's in the pouch or it's a tea bag like format. You put it in the bottom of your gum and it absorbs that way. So they're not always tobacco derived. Some of it is synthetic tobacco. But the idea there is for the nicotine to absorb into your system. It's way less harmful than cigarettes because you're not inhaling anything. So, and then heat not burn or tobacco heated products. So that's, it's a cigarette-like thing. But I guess the difference is that instead of burning the cigarette, you just heat it up. So it's a device, you put a stick into it, it heats up the tobacco stick, and then you inhale it from there. So vapors is one that we worry about a bit because of the usage patterns, and it's probably the one that needs to be regulated the most. But I mean, if you walked in any public space, you probably inhaled a vapor cloud from someone walking in front of you.
Maybe let's just touch on some of the regulatory issues around vaping, particularly in the US. And maybe if you can just unpack kind of the difference in behavior between maybe the traditional tobacco companies, the likes of Philip Morris and British American Tobacco, versus some of the kind of new entrants into that market and how they both kind of respond to the environment differently in terms of how they market, who they market to, and the like.
So I guess if we were doing this podcast, say, what's it, 5-10 years ago, to describe vaping to a big proportion of people, I guess in the US especially, you'd call it juuling. So, you know, when something becomes a verb, you know that the product becomes quite big in terms of market share. So the problem with vaping is that because it's deemed as, I don't know, cool, it's easily accessible, and there's lots of flavors, that it does have an appeal to underage people. So because it has that appeal, a lot of people have been taking advantage of that. And how they do it, they have, you know, these flavored stuff like, you know, velvet chocolate and caramel flavored vapes, and often made irresponsibly. And when I say irresponsibly, there'll be like, you know, thousands and thousands of puffs in a disposable vapor. And what that does is, you know, if you have too many puffs, say 5,000 puffs, the equipment itself starts to degrade. So the metal itself starts to melt and you start to inhale things that you shouldn't inhale. So what the US has been trying to do, probably not successfully, or definitely not successfully at the moment, is to, they call it PMTA. So it's like a pre-market authority thing that you have to get. You submit a whole lot of applications to show the public health benefits of vapor or your product, right? So to prove that your product doesn't you know, appeal to underage users. So flavors have more or less been banned at the moment, and disposables, to make sure that if you do have disposables, that they are responsible, and the disposables are more or less banned as well. So the traditional companies are being more careful, and they understand that you have to build these products with quality. So you have to make sure that the actual components make sense and can last for the right amount of time, and you don't, you know, extend it for too long, that the nicotine level is not too strong, that they're not flavored weirdly or flavored for kids, and that they market them responsibly, which is very important. So not, you know, marketing on Instagram to like kids and stuff, which is what got Juul in a whole lot of trouble in the past.
So assuming the regulatory net tightens, and not just in the US, but a number of other markets, far from a guarantee, but if you look at kind of the market shares of the major players in those markets today, is it fair to say that, that British American Tobacco is one of the front runners in terms of a higher quality, safer product when it comes to vaping?
Yeah, I think in most of their markets, so the US and Canada's the big markets for vapor for them, they have massive market share. So they're by far the biggest products at the moment, and probably the better quality products, I think. Also, they have these massive distribution chains, so they're able to get it to more places. If it's not regulated, these disposable stuff can be like cheaper or maybe a bit more fun for the user. So as long as it's not regulated, it's actually very difficult to compete, because you're competing on a non-equal plane where the other products care less about the long-term detriment, I guess, to the consumer. So I think in a world where the regulators get it right, it should almost be obvious that the big players get the market share. But it's been very difficult over the last few years, and these illicit products have been taking a whole lot of share, especially in countries like the US.
And then if we just shift slightly to modern oral pouches, So despite the fact that you didn't make them sound particularly appealing, they've actually exploded in popularity in the Western world. So who are the big brands? Who are the market leaders? How quickly are they growing?
I've never smoked before, but I've tried out the pouches, and I think they are quite cool. It's very different to cigarettes, and it's, you know, it's not going to make your breath smell or anything like that. And I guess the appeal is, so sometimes you watch a soccer game or you watch some sports and you see the coach take this thing out of their mouth, because you can do it anywhere, right? You can be on a flight, you can be in the office, you can be on the side of the pitch as a coach. So it's a very clear appeal. And when you look at the health stats or the health benefits in countries, the Scandinavian countries particularly, that have a big tradition of oral tobacco for very long, so their incidence of smoking-related cancer is much lower than the rest of the world because of that. You could assume it's because of that. It's just very different if you don't have the tradition of oral tobacco, because it's a change. So it's growing very fast. The biggest brand at the moment is, okay, in the US at least, is Zyn. But in Scandinavian countries, the Velo by BAT is the biggest product. You know, this regulatory thing is the issue for BAT as well. They can't bring in their better products into the US because they have to wait for the like application that takes a very long time and like millions of dollars to file. But it's growing incredibly. So in the last result, for now, I guess for the next 6 months or for the coming 6 months to June, BAT expects this product to grow by triple digits.
In over 100%.
Yeah, which is over 100%. You don't often see that for a lot of products. So that's growing a lot. The nice thing about it, or at least on the economics of it, is it's very cheap to produce. You know, cigarettes economics are very difficult to match, right? But I think this is the only product that can probably make a higher margin than US cigarettes, which is a very high margin business. So if that grows, it's actually probably you're going to grow your revenue faster, but you're also going to grow your earnings faster, and you're going to grow that revenue, which will be very good. They are pricing at a massive discount in the US to the market leader. And I guess it's trying to gain market share.
When you say a massive discount, like 10, 15, 20%?
It's a bit more than that. Yeah,
more than that.
Yeah. So it's big discounts to the market leader. And you hope that once they've gotten the market share that they want or increase their distribution points, then they close the gap over time.
They've probably needed to price at a discount, just given Zyn was so far ahead of you in the market and kind of came to market first. So I guess as a result, it's probably that usual strategy. You kind of pull back on pricing a bit, hope to get the word out, hope to get the distribution out, and then you can, to your point, price up over time as and when your brand is kind of a bit more accepted in the market.
The other great thing, I guess, for British American Tobacco is that it would have been last year, I think. This category has grown so fast that Zyn ran out of production capacity. So as they ran out of production capacity, they had massive market share. Then you release, you have your products, you have that price discount, and then you're increasing your distribution points. So they captured a whole lot of market share. And it seems like they do have a better product. You know, sometimes we talk about these businesses doing acquisitions and stuff. So what BAT has been doing quite well in the more recent history is they've been buying smaller brands or smaller businesses that they plug into their big global distribution chain. So I think it was at the end of last year, they bought a small nicotine pouch business that had a better product than what they were able to sell in the US. They talk about moisture content, so it had a higher moisture content. Why moisture content is important? Obviously, if you're putting a dry tea bag into your mouth versus one that's a little bit wet, that's a big difference in how you can absorb it. So from a lot of survey data, it seems like it's one of the better products out there. So, you know, if you capture that market share while Zyn doesn't have the ability to produce, you get people to use your stuff and like, oh, this is actually better for us. And then maybe you keep the market share when Zyn has fixed or they have already fixed, you know, fixed their production issues.
Okay, great. Well, then let's just tie it back to valuation. So we've spoken a bit about the kind of traditional cigarettes and declining volumes and some of the economic challenges there. But then we've also spoken about the next generation products. So maybe how big are those as it stands today in the life of British American Tobacco? And when you buy a share in British American Tobacco, you know, what are you paying and what is the kind of upside from here?
We often find value, or at least as an analyst, it's very interesting to analyze businesses that are in a period of flux or change. Effectively, what British American Tobacco does is what they've been doing forever, which is delivering nicotine for consumers or adult consumers who enjoy that. But the form factor has changed, right? So then you have to think, okay, is the nicotine market declining a lot? No, it actually isn't anymore. And you found products that take that or that help grow the nicotine category overall, even though cigarettes are declining. And then you pull back and think, okay, is British American Tobacco likely to get their fair share of that market that's increasing? And I think, yes. So then you look at, you know, the growth rates of the two things. So the declining rates of the cigarettes versus the growth rates of the new generation products, they call them, but they used to call them NGPs. So then you look at the growth rates of that and you look at the relative economics and think, okay, if this carries on, what is earnings likely to look like, you know, in the next 5-10 years? And should we pay a decent multiple for that? So our thinking is that they've done a good enough job in investing in these new generation products to get their fair share of what is now a slightly growing nicotine category, such that earnings can continue to grow. And the sort of demand profile, the revenue profile actually looks better than what it would have looked like 5 years ago. And you're not paying up for that. So you're paying, I think it's about 10 times earnings at the moment for that. Dividend yield around 7% in sterling that's actually going to grow over time. And at the same time, there's a lot of other things that are going right for the business. So the balance sheet is looking a bit better than what it looked like, used to look like in the past. They'll be able to do more buybacks. They have a massive stake in an Indian tobacco company that's at a much higher valuation than themselves, which they're able to sell down if and when required. So not paying up for what has been a change in the demand profile and probably the earnings trajectory of the business. I mean, on the flip side, there's always going to be risk in investing in a highly regulated industry like tobacco. So also being cognizant of that. And probably that's why a lot of the valuations are not as high as they were in the past. But, you know, some of their peers are on 20 times earnings and BAT on 10 times earnings. So, you know, just a little bit of imagination of where that could go, plus the growing earnings. It looks like a good investment idea to me.
Effectively, I guess, a fair amount of upside optionality in the next generation products that doesn't look like it's reflected in the price at all today. Now, no guarantee that those will materialize. Yeah. But kind of a risk-reward perspective, it sounds like it's skewed quite nicely to the upside.
Yeah, and if you look at the recent earnings trajectory, like, you would never think that in the last, what has it been, 5 years now, 7 years, they've actually been building a new business. Because the earnings have actually been growing, the dividends have been growing. So the income statement hasn't been horrible, even though they've been investing to build a new business effectively. And these new generation products only started making profits, proper profits, like a year ago, right? So, and contributing to the growth, and now they're contributing the major part of the earnings growth. So to be able to actually reinvest and build a new business without really impacting your financials a huge amount, you get to the point, the inflection point at which they start to contribute to the growth. At the same time as your balance sheet starts to improve, you can almost see, I guess, in the last, what is it, year or 6 months, that the market's starting to believe a bit. And it gets a bit exciting when the market starts to see, and the imagination starts to see what we've been seeing for years and as long-suffering shareholders sometimes have been holding on to. Because I guess we are long-term investors and we've been waiting for this to sort of play out over time.
Okay, great. Well, that sounds very promising. From one Sin stock to another, let's shift to AB InBev. So beer for the longest time was just about the best business to be in. And we saw throughout the 90s and the 2000s, the better beer companies were consolidating, every year growing volumes, every year pushing prices, phenomenal economics if you got it right. And we saw that in South Africa with SAB Miller, one of the best shares to own on the JSE, pretty much from 2000 right up until they were themselves acquired by AB InBev in 2015, 2016. But then for much of the last decade, AB InBev has not been a good share to own. What's gone wrong, Jathin?
To your point, this is going back hundreds of years now. You know, the kind of wealthiest people in the village were generally the kind of local owner of the brewery and maybe the kind of textile factory. Maybe this tells you kind of where things have gone. The brewery part, I think, is still true. And if you look at the economics of beer, it's very attractive because it's a simple product to make and you can charge, relative to what it costs, you can charge a lot for it. So, you know, if you think beer is effectively four main ingredients, you'll vary the kind of quantities and maybe the variations of those ingredients to make different kinds of beer. But, you know, it's not kind of fundamentally different from one style to the other. But you can then charge quite a substantial margin or a premium for that product. So, you know, these are effectively kind of marketing organizations. And to your point, you know, when you get it right, it goes very well. AB InBev was kind of the classic consolidator in the industry. You know, they started off with a Brazilian brewery, consolidated their position in Brazil, went into Europe, went into the US, and then bought SAB, to your point, in 2016 in South Africa. And I think, you know, where things went wrong for AB InBev over the last, let's call it, since effectively the SAB acquisition, was their playbook had been taken a lot of debt, do these very big acquisitions, and then hope to grow your way out of it, use the kind of very strong free cash flow generation to repay the debt. And that worked very well until you came to SAB. So they, you know, they paid over $100 billion for SAB, fully funded with debt, took on that debt, and then things disappointed. So they had this very, very big debt load. Unfortunately, it happened to be probably just as the dollar was shooting the lights out or started to shoot the lights out versus every other currency, especially emerging market currencies. So if you think about, you know, the ABI business today, it has a large part of its business in emerging markets. And if you think about how beer is sold and produced, you know, you generally sell beer in a specific country in local currency, but some of your inputs to that beer, like aluminium for the cans or barley where you import it, you know, those are dollar-denominated commodities. So to the extent that you're pricing in, let's say, Brazilian real and your inputs are in dollars and the real is depreciating, it squeezes your margins. And that's exactly what happened to ABI, kind of just as it did the SAB deal. So they took on this very big debt load and then its economics started to deteriorate. You know, first in Brazil, then in kind of other emerging markets that followed. So to your point, the revenue growth, the EBITDA growth, probably slightly disappointed. And on top of that, you now had this very big debt load that you had recently assumed that wasn't going away. So I think that's why you saw kind of a big underperformance for the share, very big gearing, and then kind of economics that's slightly disappointed.
And what's happened to that debt?
You know, as much as I say the economics have deteriorated, you know, they are still very high margin, healthy businesses. And importantly, you know, AB InBev converts more than 100% of its earnings into cash. You know, that's ultimately, I think, what we care about. You know, you can't repay debt with earnings, you repay debt with cash. So what they've done since then is they've, you know, kind of 2 or 3 years post acquisition, they realized they need to be more aggressive in repaying this debt. So what they did is they cut the dividend or they rebased it lower and then took effectively more of the free cash flow to de-gear. They stopped doing deals, they stopped buying things, and they just paid back debt steadily every single year. The other thing that's been helpful is that some of the emerging markets, in, especially in the kind of last year, year and a half, a lot of those emerging markets, the kind of economics have started to improve. You know, as these currencies have stopped depreciating versus the dollar, consumers have been a bit more wealthier, so are kind of consuming beer a little bit more again. You know, the net result of it is actually the debt is now to a point where it's completely...
Just put some of those debt numbers in context. I mean, how big was it post-acquisition and where is it today?
Post-acquisition, we look at a metric called net debt to EBITDA, and that's basically, you know, how much debt do you have relative to your earnings before interest, tax, and depreciation. And, you know, that number was over 5 times when they bought SAB. That number, with the kind of December reporting period, came down below the psychological 3 times. You know, that's quite an important thing for the market. You know, people, I think we took a slightly different view. You know, we looked at whether the debt was repayable, were there covenants that would kick in that would hurt the company. You know, there wasn't any of that, but there is a psychological kind of 3 times net debt to EBITDA level that the company's now below. So, you know, to our minds, there isn't a debt problem. And more interestingly, we think the actual economics or the earnings of their underlying businesses look far more attractive today than they did, let's say, 3 years ago. And maybe we can get into that.
Okay, so the debt has gone from probably excessive to a far more manageable position. And they face significant headwinds in terms of emerging market currencies relative to the US dollar, much of which looks to be in the price. And if anything, it's past an inflection point where, as you say, the economics are actually improving now in many of these markets. So what are we seeing that the market is missing, or rather, you know, what are the other big things that the market is worried about then?
So the other thing that we can maybe draw some parallels with BTI on is the US. So they kind of bought the Anheuser-Busch business in 2008. And so that gave them the US presence that they have today. US beer is actually... There are lots of similarities with cigarettes and how things have evolved over the last 2 decades. It's been a case of overall alcohol consumption being probably roughly stable, but within that, beer losing share of throat to spirits. So the net result was you had, you know, let's say 1 or 2% volume decline every year, but then you would try to offset that with 3 or 4% pricing. A lot of parallels were being kind of pulled with tobacco to say, well, actually, you know, is beer a structurally declining category in the US? And if it is, you know, an investor is probably not going to want to pay a very high multiple for that. I think what's changed is, and you know, I guess we've looked at, you know, alcohol cycles going back, you know, to the kind of early 1900s when data first became
prohibition.
Effectively, yeah. I guess just after prohibition. And, you know, these things tend to go in cycles. You know, the US is an interesting market because there are these cycles where kind of overall alcohol consumption stays, you know, roughly flat. But within that, you know, they're kind of 20-year cycles where beer wins and then beer loses. And I guess a lot of that has to do with the state of the economy. You know, there are various factors in that. But we seem to be getting to a point now where, you know, spirits has been winning for a long time. And actually, you know, I guess maybe on a tougher macro, you know, consumer that's struggling a bit more, what we're seeing is the reverse now. You know, beer is actually winning share of throat versus spirits again. So I think where things look a bit more constructive in the US is, you know, I think you were penciling in for ABI at least, consistent volume declines every year. I think that's changed now for firstly that reason that I spoke about. I think beer seems to be regaining some share. But then within ABI specifically, you know, their kind of two mainstay brands was Bud Light and Budweiser. And, you know, those brands are kind of the main reason for the decline. You know, they're in the mainstream segment and they've been declining for a long time. ABI has two other brands that have been growing quite quickly. And they've reached sufficient scale now that the growth from these brands should be more to offset the losses from the declining brands.
What are those two brands?
So it's a brand called Michelob Ultra. It's called what they call a Core Plus beer, but effectively, you know, when we talk about beer categories, it just means how expensive is a beer or how cheap, you know, is a beer. So it's priced at a slight premium to a Bud Light, as an example. The other brand is actually on the bottom end of the scale. It's Busch Light. So that's what we would call a value beer. You know, it's actually priced slightly lower than Bud Light. And maybe that's a sign of the times. You know, it's if the consumer is struggling in the US, you know, the top end consumers can still premiumize, as we would call it. You know, you can still trade up from a Bud Light to a Michelob, but the kind of core US consumer that maybe is feeling a bit of pain, you know, probably that down trading to a Busch Light, often not from an ABI brand, but from another competitor brand. You know, you wouldn't want that within the ABI portfolio, but if it's coming from a competitor, that's okay.
And then, I mean, just to come back to something earlier you said, so you spoke about kind of the ebb and the flow between spirits and beer and how, you know, for a period of time, one might be winning market share and then the other. But just how do you think about kind of some of the longer term structural challenges we might see in the future? So we've seen the advent of obesity drugs, the likes of Ozempic and Mounjaro, which will result in impulse and quantity control. And then it looks like there's some generational trends happening where if you look at kind of Gen Z and Gen Alpha or Gen AI, they may be the lonely generations because they're far more likely to spend Friday night at home playing computer games in their mom's basements. But they also tend to be far more health conscious.
Yeah.
So they might consume less alcohol altogether or zero alcohol beers. So how do you think about those trends in terms of longer term risks to just, I guess, alcohol consumption in totality?
We saw it at the beginning of 2025, you know, kind of, I would argue, peak worry about, well, consumer staples more broadly, but then particularly alcohol and beer. I think that there's kind of three big themes in there. You know, the first, as you talked about, GLP-1s, or, you know, the kind of obesity drugs, allegedly the kind of miracle drugs that, you know, solve everything, will stop you gambling, will stop you doing just about everything bad. But yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, I guess we've tried to go to the science. I guess the caveat here is it's still early. You know, these drugs haven't been out a long time. Studies that have been done on consumption more broadly are pretty limited, either in sample size or duration. So putting that all together, I guess what we can see is for people that stay on these drugs for a decent amount of time, there is almost certainly a drop-off in consumption. And this is on, you know, be it sugary snacks or beer or whatever the case is. I guess there are a few things to consider there. You know, the first thing with these, I guess, weight loss drugs, I think the persistency of people staying on them for a decent amount of time, given the side effects that are now emerging, I think that still has to be tested. The other thing that I think is interesting for these weight loss drugs is it, by and large, skews to women. So the last numbers that I looked at, you know, 80% of these drugs were kind of taken by women. You know, in beer, that reverses. Actually, 80% consumed by men in the US. There are risks, and the risks we're monitoring on weight loss drugs, but I think from what we can see thus far, these are risks that are manageable. And to your point, you know, there are other categories that these beer stocks and ABI in particular have to offer. So, you know, you talked about non-alcoholic beer, for example, growing very strongly, particularly in the US, I guess, where these risks are greater. Actually, it's pretty incremental to beer because, again, you don't necessarily want one of your beer drinkers switching to non-alcoholic. It's fine if that happens, if they would have left you anyway. But actually, these non-alcoholic drinks are tending to bring new consumers into the market. And for the economics of this non-alcoholic beer, it's very attractive because there's no excise because there's no alcohol. So you actually price them at a premium to normal beer, but you capture
far more of the profit margin.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Maybe just a quick question to you. Because, I mean, I guess there's no excise for these new generation tobacco stuff as well. So it makes for good economics. Why do people drink zero alcohol beers? Like, who's the drinker of that? And what's the appeal almost?
As we chatted about, I think there are a few points here. So the one is what the beer companies would call occasion development, and that there are certain occasions that don't lend themselves to alcohol. Like if you're at a business meeting during lunch, actually, you know, they would say that's a brand new consumption occasion where now a zero alcohol beer can be consumed. And I think Rory did so quite successfully at our roadshow more recently. With the other consumer, I guess you could argue, and maybe this gets into the next point of the kind of youth consumption. You know, there's a big narrative out there that young people are more health conscious than kind of older generations. And it's difficult to see if that's actually true. It's anecdotal, but, you know, what we can see is it looks like there is a drop in young people drinking alcohol more broadly, But you can also square that with young people leaving home much later and socializing less, to Rory's point. So from what we can see, you know, when people kind of pass 30, which now seems to be the age that you become an adult, which is a little bit scary, but anyway, when people are now leaving home after 30 and getting jobs after 30, you know, they tend to consume as much as they would have, as previous generations would have. But for that kind of category below that, you know, if you are kind of at home, you're a little bit more kind of socially unaware, you are a bit more health conscious, I guess you would think that's the natural consumer for non-alcoholic
beer. Yeah, I mean, I think the desire to socially conform is just so incredibly strong in the human species. And so if everyone else is drinking, the closest thing in approximation to drinking is a non-zero beer. Yeah. So I'm not drinking a cool drink, I'm drinking beer just like you guys, only I'm taking a slightly healthier approach, or maybe I want to limit my alcohol consumption. So I'll have two regular beers and then two alcohol-free beers. I do want to get to Disney. What are the big things people are worried about there?
It feels like a lot of these, or the three businesses, have very similar stories to some extent. So industries in flux. The main thing is the main thing, and that's still doing better than you think. And then the form factor of the main thing has changed a bit. Also, they've all made like big acquisitions. So Disney paid a whole lot for Fox. That's paid a whole lot for their US business. AB InBev paid a whole lot for SAB. So for Disney, they've had this linear business. So linear is, you know, old school TV, like DSTVS. So, you know, 8 o'clock, it's this generation's plays. At 9:30, this plays. And it's that. So that's linear almost, where it's programmatic TV and they make shows for that. Distributed in different ways in the US. It's not just a satellite, sometimes it's cable. So that business has been declining over time. And before COVID, the price increases could make up for the decline in volumes or viewers. But then after COVID, the numbers, they call it cord cutting. The cord cutting's accelerated to such an extent that the pricing hasn't been able to make up for that. And the main reason for that is the new form factor, the way of watching it, which has been streaming, has been growing much, much more. Linear TV had amazing economics. So they made like 30% plus mid-30s margins, probably a bit higher actually, if you had to clean up for the other stuff that are in that business. So the sports side made a lower margin than the actual just like general entertainment, but very high margins. And streaming is tricky to build up, and the economics are, call it, untested relative to linear. So I think that's the major risk of the business. And then similar to the rest, they had, you know, took up a massive debt load, issued shares to buy Fox. And then you have to, like, the capital returns almost reduce for a while you know, work your way out of the debt.
So obviously they've got Disney Plus in the streaming. So is the market just skeptical that Disney Plus will be nowhere near as successful as something like Netflix has already been?
Even if it is, or it's already as successful as linear on the revenue side, it's just the economics of linear were so good. In the same way that the economics of cigarettes are so good, it's some of the hardest businesses to replace economics-wise, even if you can have a better revenue trajectory. Interestingly enough, I guess this has changed my opinion as well. Netflix has been doing a very good job at actually getting their margin up. So the economics actually can improve, and there's a few things you can do, and the industry has to change to some extent or consolidate to actually allow the economics to be the same. Disney Plus probably will not be as widespread as Netflix, because Netflix has a wider net of, you know, type of content. But Disney Plus, because of its unique content or IP, has a place in a bundle of streaming services. Because people, I mean, in the US, people use 3 to 4 different streaming services for different needs. So if you love Star Wars like you do, you're probably going to have your Disney Plus. I mean, it feels weird talking about Disney to someone who's probably the biggest consumer of Disney products that I know, which is Rory.
And I guess before we get sidetracked with what I do on the weekends, which is attending Star Wars conventions, no, just kidding. There's other parts of the Disney business that are also incredibly valuable, which I think the market kind of underappreciates.
The big thing with Disney, everyone talks, or I guess they talk about it in a bit. Walt, who started the business like 100 years, a bit more than 100 years ago, he drew like this famous little doodle or graph thing. And it's about what the different parts of the business are. And there's a whole lot of different parts, but at the center of the business, it was the content engine, the IP creation engine. So, you know, the character development, the world development. And what they've done very well is to centering around creating characters and worlds, monetize that in different formats. So it might be the, you know, the doll that you have, if you call it a doll.
Grogu.
The Grogu doll. It's the theme parks. It's the content on streaming. It's the movies. It's the plays. It's the music. It's a whole lot of different things. But what has been the main driver of earnings in the more recent history has been the theme parks. So the theme parks make about 60% of operating earnings at the moment. And those have been growing incredibly well and have been investing a whole lot into that to keep, you know, the rides fresh, to grow out the world, because the queues can be very long. So in reality, for every one person who goes to the park, there's probably a multiple of people who would be willing to go, but they're just so full. So if we often talk about return on capital in investing, but oftentimes Jatin likes to say this, it's about the return on incremental capital. So when you retain money, what are you able to invest in? And does that have a better, similar return to what the overall business is? And because there's so much demand for these theme parks, the money that Disney retains, the money that they invest in, has very high incremental returns on capital. So an example is they have ships, these cruise ships that they're investing in right now, that make higher margins in the existing theme parks, pay back in a year or two, and make earnings from their first quarter. It's incredible what they can do with that.
And I also saw in their latest kind of earnings announcement that they're going to build a theme park in the Middle East, in the Emirates. I presume that's even better economics, because by all intent and purposes, the Emirates are going to pay for the theme park.
So, Disney announced a $60 billion 10-year investment in the segments of the business. But not included in that $60 billion is the Abu Dhabi theme park that will be built. I don't know how long these things take, but it will be built, which a different business will actually build it, and Disney will just run, effectively help run the operation. So, you know, license the content and make sure that the IP vision or the content vision makes sense in the park. So that will be incredibly high return, because they're not going to put in much money, and it's probably going to look, you know, just knowing that part of the world and how they build things, it's going to be one of the best looking parks in the world, probably. and they're not going to put any of their own capital down for that. And it grows the brands in underrepresented parts of the world. And, you know, when you grow those brands in underrepresented parts of the world, it's good for the streaming business, it's good for the movies business, it's good for a lot of the other businesses. In the same way that the ships, I think one of them were birthed in Singapore, for example, where there's no park. So you're growing the brands and access to the brands in underrepresented parts of the world.
So, you've got these tentpole franchises that you can just monetize in so many different ways. So just maybe 30 seconds on the valuation of Disney.
On a standalone multiple, it's one of the higher multiple business in our portfolio. So at about 20, 21 times current earnings or forward earnings. But the beauty of this is, because it has such strong businesses. So first is a business in disruption, which is the linear to streaming. And I've changed my mind about streaming. I think that the margins and can actually start to look a bit closer to linear if you do the right thing. So industry consolidation, more pricing, advertising tiers, password sharing, which is annoying to a lot of people, but it is what it is. You have to pay for what you get. So that part of the business is growing and probably going to look better than people expect. And then you have this underpin of value, which is the parks business that has been growing earnings incredibly well throughout the cycle. You know, recessions hurt it a bit, but it always comes back. And the CAGR, the sort of the annual growth rate there has been very good. So they think they can grow their earnings by double digits at some point. So high single digits now and then going to double digits. In dollars, I think that 20 times is I'm very comfortable paying that for that business. So high quality business that should trade at a higher than market multiple with very strong IP that's difficult to replicate and very unique.
Impossible to replicate, I would argue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, someone can buy it. Apple's trying to buy Disney, we'll sell at the right price. But very difficult to replicate content that has been put together from their own internal engines and very smart acquisitions over time.
Thank both of you for joining me in this conversation today. You know, we've discussed kind of three household names: British American Tobacco, AB InBev, and Disney. We've learned that debt is bad for you. But at the same time, we've also learned that, you know, in industries subject to disruption and uncertainty, you can often find a lot of value in very familiar places. You don't necessarily have to go looking in esoteric and unfamiliar places. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized financial services provider. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. www.rorikitiska.co.za. Until next time, I am Rory Kitiska-Jacobson. Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do. Even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.